Welcome to the Writing Talk podcast with Mikey Campling.
Hello, I'm Mikey Campling and welcome to episode 7 of the Writing Talk podcast. That feels quite good actually to be getting to episode 7. I'm afraid I'm a day late today. There wasn't one yesterday because I had a migraine. But that is more or less over with. But bear with me if I do anything or say anything too stupid. Okay, today's topic is twofold really. It's about beta readers and how you get that to work, and also about head hopping, which is part of the writing craft. So it's kind of two parts to it. So to kick off with, we'll get into beta readers. Now, if you're not sure what beta readers are, then first of all, it probably means you're quite new to the writing scene. So welcome. You're very welcome indeed. You're exactly the kind of people who I thought this podcast would be for, though, of course, everybody's welcome. Beta readers are someone who reads your work whilst it's in an early version. So typically that would be a while before it was sent off to a professional editor. Often people start out with members of family and friends and loved ones and so on. And certainly that's what I did. I think that's probably the way most people go. And for obvious reasons, partly because when you first start writing, you're reluctant to show people. I mean, I would encourage you to try and get over that hurdle if you can, because that's what it's all about. I mean, if you really just want to write for yourself, and that is, of course, absolutely fine. But if you want to have something published in any way at all, even if it's on a blog or somewhere public, then really you should get it checked out with somebody first. Now, that's quite a commitment. If, say, you've written a novel, you might be asking somebody to read your massive four-part epic. So, you know, it does require a certain bit of care. I would suggest that, although it's a great way to start, asking your spouse or your close friends isn't a very good long-term strategy. If you can, I'd try and move away from that. It can be really good, especially if, say, like sometimes my kids have been in my target demographic and I've been thinking, okay, well, if they like it, you know, that's the good sign. But of course they're going to say they like it. You know, they're my kids, they're great kids, so they're bound to say that, aren't they? You know, they're not going to say, well, Dad, it kind of sucks. I mean, they might, you don't know, you know, perhaps they might now they're a bit older, but on the whole, you're not going to get a very objective viewpoint from your nearest and dearest. So if you can try and find some people who you can trust with your work and will also give you a bit of helpful feedback. I mean, these could be online contacts these days. I would suggest that you wait until you've built up a reasonable relationship with some people so that there is kind of a common understanding about who's doing what and what it's all about. Because I think if you get some really harsh criticism from somebody, it could be very dispiriting. And equally, if somebody says, oh yeah, well, I just liked it, it was fantastic, again, you don't really know whether that's a genuine thing or whether they're just, you know, being nice. So this is something that I'm really just going into at the moment, and I've got to work with a few beta readers at the moment, and I'm finding it absolutely worth its weight in gold, especially one person who's a fellow writer. And that can work as, I mean, you could even trade. I know quite a few people do this. They sort of trade beta reads with each other, or perhaps they've formed a Facebook group or something like that, and they're trading reads and doing each other a favour. And that's actually pretty good. If you can get somebody who kind of knows the business and knows what they're doing, perhaps even writing in a similar genre to you or the same genre, then that is very useful indeed. Okay, now it's quite important if you're going to ask somebody to make a commitment of time and effort to do this thing, that you do it with some kind of guidelines in place, some kind of clear expectation on all sides. Because if you just give it to somebody and say, here it is, please read it, then they either maybe they won't get round to it, you know, people have busy lives, or perhaps they'll just say, oh yeah, I really liked it, or yeah, no, not for me. And, you know, it's not actually particularly useful for you. So I've been hunting around to find out how to make use of this myself. And here's some really good tips that I came across, and I'll tell you where from in a second. So four simple things to ask people to look out for and to comment on when you give them your manuscript. The first is to look out for anything that's absolutely fantastic. Ask them to point out their really favourite parts, because you know, you can tell them, well, I don't want to cut that out by accident later. So if you think something is absolute gold, you know, let me know. The Second thing is anything where they found themselves getting a bit bored, anything where their interest, you know, wavered and they thought, I'm going to put the book down now, you know, maybe I'm not even going to finish it. So ask them specifically to name those sections. Similarly, any sections where they were just scratching their head, so any parts that are just too confusing for them to follow. Now that's a slightly tricky one because it could be, for instance, where you've built up some suspense and you might have to explain to them that you're not just looking for the parts where you're thinking, oh, I don't understand what's going to happen next, because that's, you know, perhaps exactly the effect that you want. You know, we don't want them to know who the murderer is straight away in your mystery story. But if anything is just so confusing that they really don't know who is what and where they are and, you know, who's talking to who, any sections like that, we really need to know about those, because those are things that are easy to put in by accident. For instance, one of my beta readers has just told me that I've mixed up some names, and I knew I'd done it in some places, but I thought I'd caught them all. So it's fantastic to actually have those pointed out to me, and I was really grateful for that. Easy to make a typo like that, but of course it ruins the effectiveness of the passage if you put the wrong name in the wrong order. And lastly, the fourth thing to comment on is any parts of the story that they just couldn't accept. They just didn't find them believable. They were just, you know, stretching their credibility too far. Even if you're saying, oh, you've got to suspend your disbelief, I'm writing a fantasy or something. Well, even so, those things have rules and worlds have rules. And you need to know if there's any part where you've accidentally broken or messed up those rules and the point that it's just become, you know, unbelievable. So just to summarise that, the full details of this will be listed on the site at writingtalkpodcast.com for episode 7. So looking for anything awesome, number 1. Number 2, anything that was just boring. Number 3, anything that was just far too confusing. And number 4, anything that just simply wasn't believable within the terms of the story. I'd also like to suggest what not to tell them, because it's very tempting. And my example I just gave, I'm being brave here and owning up, I had an awful feeling that I'd mixed up some names. And I thought, well, shall I say to the beta readers, OK, I have a feeling, I think I've caught them all, but I think I might have accidentally transposed a couple of names in there somewhere. And I thought, no, I won't tell them that. I'll let them see if they spot things and see, you know, see how it comes out. Because, you know, it is kind of a thing that an editor will pick up later, hopefully. But even so, I wouldn't sort of prime people's minds by telling them to look out for things that you think are wrong. I know it's very tempting. I had a couple of passages which I call them things that give me an itch. The kind of things where I sort of worked on them and rewritten them. And you leave them and instead of thinking, wow, that was great, you kind of think, well, that bit was all right. It works. It's okay. You've looked at it so many times. You're almost too close to it to really judge it. And I think if you start telling people, well, could you just look at this chunk? I don't think it works. Well, you're kind of ruining their subjectivity there. You want them just to take it as a story. And if it does work and they just read straight through it, that's absolutely fine. If they say something, you know, that fits into one of my categories there, that maybe I found it boring or maybe I just found it confusing, might well be the case. And if that happens to match up with, well, I thought that wasn't quite right either, then that's absolutely fantastic. It confirms for you then that your itch was right. And that, again, has happened to me with a piece today that I thought, this is fantastic. She's picking out exactly the things that I wondered about. And it kind of confirms it for you. And lastly, I would just say it is a commitment for people. They have got lots of other things they could be doing. And if people are good enough to be beta readers, then just make sure to show your appreciation. You know, flowers are nice, chocolates, whatever. If they're overseas, perhaps you can at least, you know, make sure you send them a nice email or something. And perhaps give them an acknowledgement in the book, which people might like as well, if they're happy with that for their name. Or if they're not, then perhaps just their first name or something, or their initials or something, just to show that, you know, you appreciate what they've done. Okay, hopefully that rounds up the quick run-through using beta readers and getting the most out of beta readers. Any questions or comments about that, please leave them on the site at writingtalkpodcast.com, and I will be sure to see them and reply to your comments. Okay, well, following on from that, I'm going to talk a bit about head hopping. Now, I hadn't even heard it called this until recently, although if you're listening to lots of writing podcasts and reading books on writing craft and so on, you might well have come across this term. To be honest, a lot of my writing that I do is fairly instinctive, and I think most of it really rests on a lifetime of reading and reading and reading and actually reading pretty good quality stuff. So I don't want to get too bogged down with technical terms. I don't want you to be bogged down with them either. But I think I'll have to explain what this is a bit before we launch into it. So what on earth's head hopping? Is it? Is it some sort of bizarre drug-induced ritual frenzy of spiritual transference or something? No, it's not. It's just a simple thing where in your writing, within the same scene, you decide to, or inadvertently perhaps, describe and tell the reader about things that are going on in the heads, particularly their internal thoughts, of more than one character. Now, lots of people will say, oh no, you must never do that. A scene must always be about one character. Some people will say, it's okay. So let's unpick it a little bit. Let's pull it apart and see what we think to it. Okay, so again, I'll be brave and I'll give you a little example from something that's a work in progress. So it's not perfect. It's not something that's finished. But the two topics linked together today because my beta reader was able to tell me, okay, you're doing some head hopping there. I thought, I kind of knew I had, but I wasn't sure. And I kind of looked at it. It was one of those things where I thought, I'm not sure about that, but I think it's okay. So I'll read this bit to you. It's from a sci-fi book I'm writing at the moment, which is almost certainly going to be called Cheat Code. Okay, so this is actually set as though it's in the USA and written with USA spellings, which has been a new experience for me. But I think with the narration, I'll stick to doing it in my own accent, if you don't mind, and then just do the voices. I think I'll do it better that way. Kilgore can't help but smile. The two men shake hands as if they're at a dinner party rather than hunched in the rubble behind a rapidly disintegrating SUV with bullets and RPGs raining down on every side. "So what's your plan?" Kilgore says. "Don't tell me you've got a bunch of mines laid out again, unless..." He lets his voice trail away. "I wouldn't put it past him," he thinks. But Will just grins, enjoying the look on his new friend's face. "Like a kid waiting for Christmas." "Not mines," he says, "but I do have something up my sleeve." Okay, so in that chunk there, I started off with the main character, Kilgore, and I was telling you his thoughts and so on. And then I jumped over to this other character called Will, and I told you that he was enjoying the look on his new friend's face, and his thoughts were like a kid waiting for Christmas. Now, if we're focusing on the Kilgore character, then really you could argue that although it's clear who exactly is thinking what and who's saying what in that piece, it's not necessarily good practice. And it could just jar the reader a little bit and take them out of the moment. Now, when I look at that, it's kind of a balanced decision. But I think on balance, we don't really need the additional information that I've given, and I've fallen into another sort of easy to fall into trap, really, which I'm doing things a bit redundantly. If you say something once, try to avoid just repeating it. It's very easy to have somebody, you know, say, oh, somebody was angry, and then, you know, "I'm angry," he shouted, sort of thing. That's a bit of a silly example, but I think you know what I mean, that it's quite easy to put something in a character's dialogue and also describe the character's emotion, and you don't really need both. So if from that last chunk I cut out the piece that says enjoying the look on his new friend's face, I think the fact that he's grinning is enough to say he's happy about something. And the like a kid waiting for Christmas doesn't particularly add much to it. So that last part of the text becomes, but Will just grins. "Not mines," he says, "but I do have something up my sleeve." And yeah, I might yet go back and rework that to some degree, but I think it's kind of snappy without that extra information, and it keeps the reader firmly focused on the main character, and that is really where I want them, because my character Kilgore is the protagonist, if you like, or the main character in the story that I really want everybody to focus on. We follow his journey through the story. Now, I don't want to upset anybody. You might think, well, I head hop and it's all fine. It can work, and it is quite common practice, particularly in certain genres. Now, I haven't done a study of this. I have come across articles online that say it's quite common in romance, for instance. And I'm not sure about that. I think I can imagine that it could be because the readers are really wanting to know what each character is thinking and feeling. I would suggest that it's probably best avoided. I think if you think of your scene, your little mini episode of action or significance in your story, as imagine it as being the sort of smallest unit of your story that you can have, your scene. And there is, whether you've thought about it in advance or not, there is a purpose to that scene. And there is probably a main character leading the action or taking part in some way in that scene. There is somebody the audience would focus on. If it was a play at this moment, then perhaps there would be the spotlight on one character. So rather than bamboozle ourselves with technical writing terms, let's just imagine a scene is being played out. Where's the main spotlight? Is it on a certain character, or is that spotlight flicking crazily from one to the other? And I think we probably all know which we'd prefer. If you go back to Shakespeare, you can imagine some of the most famous bits of Shakespeare plays are soliloquies, aren't they? Where those are the bits that lots of people know. They're the famous speeches by Hamlet or from Macbeth or something that everybody knows. And they are incredibly sort of tense and moving moments, or tragic or romantic or whatever. Having said that, remember that your scenes can be very, very short. They could be just really a few sentences. So if you feel you've got to dive into somebody else's emotions, perhaps, or thoughts, then why not just give them the next little scene? I think that's absolutely fine. Leave a blank line just to let everybody know, just to signal it. A paragraph break isn't really enough. A paragraph break is still going to be confusing to some readers. You're going to lose some of them there. So I think just give them a chunk and leave a blank line. The little asterisks you might put on that line are sort of optional. They often mean a passage of time, whereas I think a blank line is good enough, reasonably common practice to tell us that we're changing our viewpoint in some way. Okay, so where does that leave us with our point of view, or our POV, as people often like to call it? Head hopping is not the same as having a certain point of view, which some people often refer to as omniscient or all-knowing, all-seeing sort of thing. Some books are written in that way. And if your story is told by a narrator who can see magically inside everybody's heads and give us all their thoughts, that's absolutely fine. I think you should make that very clear from the beginning of the story or the piece that you're working on. I think whichever you decide to do, do it early on and stick to it. Just been trying to think of some examples off the top of my head that are omniscient. You can kind of look that up, I should think. But if you think of something like Dylan Thomas's famously long poem of Under Milk Wood, that is told by an omniscient narrator who goes round looking at all various characters, living and dead, in this little village, and tells you kind of what their thoughts are in a wonderfully effective way. And it's something, as listeners to it or readers, we're very in on that. We understand that from the beginning, that the scene is being described from an external point of view. Rather than following any one character, we have each of them described in loving detail. Again, if you're quite new to writing, perhaps, you might not be used to even thinking about points of view. Commonly, we are looking at a sort of first-person type point of view, where we are following a character and they are referring to themselves as I and me. Okay, so that would be like a first person usage, and third person would be when you are perhaps referring to people as he and she and using their names to refer to them. And generally, it's commonly accepted, I think, by most readers and most writers that it's okay to describe things which the main character, whichever person you're using, first person or third person, to describe things that they can reasonably see or sense in some way or know in some way. And it can be quite confusing for a reader if you suddenly start giving them thoughts and internal feelings from more than one character within the same little scene. And they are much better, I think, separated out into separate scenes. Okay, I was going to do some readings, I hoped, of things that people have submitted from last week's podcast, but I guess we're still a bit early days for that because I had one, so thank you very much, Stephen. That was very good of you to do something. It was great, so thank you. I went and had a look. But I think perhaps that was a bit preemptive of me. I better hold off on that for the moment, and we'll see if we can do some readings of assignments that people have done later. Perhaps when we've built up a bit more of a following, of people have got a bit more to go with, because it'd be nice to have a bit of variety and so on with that. And perhaps we could even make some special episodes where we have thing, you know, I can read out things that people have sent in. That'd be great. But for now, I'm going to just go through and, you know, here's me holding my hands up and being brave and saying guilty as charged. I've just combed a bit of one of my books, Trespass, to find a bit of what you could easily consider. Yeah, I mean, it is head hopping. I'll admit it. I hate to admit it. I mean, would I do it like that now? Probably not, because I wrote this a while ago. It's possibly okay because they're sort of slightly mini scenes, but I didn't leave the all important, I think, blank line. But we'll see what you think, and I'll read you a little chunk. My voice is going a bit today, but I'll do my best with it. Okay, so this is from Chapter 6 of Trespass, A Tale of Mystery and Suspense Across Time. And this is from one of the chapters that is set in 3500 BC. Berlik barely noticed the sounds of the village fading into the distance as he strode into the night. He thought only of Wiccan and revenge. Ahead, the path led into the forest, into darkness, into wind-creaked branches and shifting shadows, into the lair of the spirits, the shades. This is their time, Berlik thought. This is their forest. He should stop, turn back. He stumbled, tripping over his feet, but he did not slow his pace. Just you wait, Wiccan, he muttered. You can't stop me with your trickery now. Next to the path, the broad oak stood solid, unmoved by the breeze. And yet, its shadow stirred. Berlik did not see. He blundered ahead, noticed nothing. Soon it would be too late. Beneath the tree, a man watched, waited. Clumsy and careless, he thought. This shouldn't be too difficult after all. He readied himself, waited. He had been waiting for a long time. Now he could hear Berlik's every breath. He tensed. His moment had almost come, a heartbeat. And then he pounced. There was barely a whisper of rushing air as he launched himself at Berlik. Okay, and I'll stop there. Sorry if you're getting excited and you want to hear the fight that's about to result. But you'll have to go out and buy Trespass if you want to see what happens there, which would be nice. It is clearly a bit of head-hopping. We actually get the character's thoughts, and he's thinking how clumsy and careless the other person is doing. Now, if I was doing that again, I would probably be a little bit more careful. You could say that I've slipped into the omniscient point of view there, I think. Except that the rest of the book isn't really like that, and so it not even the rest of that chapter. I think that was I hold my hands up to it and say I think that was really probably a bit of an error. Although it reads okay, and you know clearly who's thinking what. I think in retrospect I would have preferred to perhaps leave a blank line if I wanted to have the little character waiting. It would be quite nice. It would be a blank line, a little bit of the character waiting. It would build up that tension. It would signal to the reader really clearly that I'd switched, and then another blank line, and then back to Berlik, and then, you know, we'll see what happened then as they crashed into each other. And that would have been clearer. But, you know, we learn as we go on, and we don't always spot things, especially when something like head-hopping weather isn't exactly a hard and fast rule. I was probably emulating subconsciously something that I read somewhere, because it is done quite a lot. I think I got away with that probably because it's a rare occurrence. I had to look quite hard to actually find myself doing that. And it's not something I did all the time. So I think on the whole, I'm pretty clear in my writing on exactly who's thinking what and who's saying what. And you might think, well, this is a bit esoteric, isn't it? It's a bit of a writery thing. You know, only another writer is going to notice. I think only another writer or an editor perhaps is going to call it head-hopping. But readers might well notice and let you know if they are confused, if they're finding it hard to follow, especially if it's a constant thing. So, you know, I perhaps got away with that single instance in a novel. I think if I was doing that five times on a page, people would be getting a bit cross with me. And the problem with writing, as you work on something, as you're very close to it, you get blind to your own errors. And you start to pick up habits, and we think, oh, this is my style, or this is my voice, or something. And what it is a bunch of habits that you've picked up. And if they're good ones, that's fantastic. And if they're bad ones, it can be a bit disastrous. And then when you get to the editing stage, you start, you know, you've got your head in your hands thinking, oh, no, what have I done? Why did I do that all those times? Okay, and I'll just kind of finish off with, I talked last episode about what I've been reading. I've been reading Fight Club by Chuck Palu. I haven't got it in front of me. Chuck Paluniak or something. I can't say it, sorry. I'll try and correct that in a future episode. But I'm sure you know what I mean when I say Fight Club. And it was good. It was a very interesting style. I mean, you could argue that it's all over the place from a style. And yet what works is the way that the writer's used his style very deliberately to convey an atmosphere of mental collapse and chaos coming in around the character. I won't give out any spoilers just in case you're one of the few people who hasn't seen the film or read the book. I mean, that's the thing that really works. And it's a thing where you can say, okay, there might be great chunks of speech where there's no speech punctuation, but it doesn't matter because it actually conveys the impression of exactly the mental state of the characters, and it moves through a very imaginative plot. Well worth a read if you haven't read the book. I don't think you'd be disappointed. You might think you've seen the film five times. You don't want to read it. The book's a bit different, and the ending is different, which is significant and actually quite interesting. I won't give that away, but a different ending. And if you pick up a new copy, you'll find a different afterword written by the author, which is also just, you know, gives you a little bit of context. It's quite interesting as well. I quite like those little kind of afterwards and things, little author's notes. And I've started reading a Neil Gaiman book called Neverwhere, which will be, I'm sure, familiar to a lot of you. I believe it was a TV series. I haven't seen that. I came across it in a relatively recent BBC Radio 4 drama. They did a really good drama, which I think was James McAvoy was the lead in that. And that was actually really nicely done. And that was really how sort of got me into reading a couple of Neil Gaiman books. I'm kind of not one of those mad sort of Neil Gaiman fans. I think there's a lot in his stories and in his wonderful imagination. I'm not sure he's totally got me as a fan just yet. I'm going to see how Neverwhere goes. I'm very early on in it, and I am finding it a little bit sort of exposition-y and a little bit sort of ploddy. And maybe that's because I kind of know that these all exciting things are going to happen later, and it's kind of taking his time getting around to it. I don't know if you've read it in novel form, because I believe it was a TV drama first, and then he wrote it as a novel. But I'll say, I'm sure I'll find it in the end. I mean, they are worthwhile getting to grips with, because I just do love his imagination and a lot of his descriptions. But I am finding some of the prose a little bit heavy work to start off with. But, you know, that's everybody's different, aren't they? And I'll see how I get on with it. I almost feel as though it's written for somebody, almost written down, almost like it's written as a slightly talking down to me a little bit kind of deliberate in the way it describes characters and so on. But this isn't really a book review show. I just thought I'd share what I was reading, and I'm sure I'll get to the end of it, and I'm sure I'll get a lot out of it. Okay, I'll tie it up there. My voice is going. I must be going down with a sore throat or something. It's middle of a rather, well, creeping into a rather grey winter as we get into December here in the UK. So endless rain and grey skies. It's probably giving me a cold or something. But anyway, sorry it's a day late this week, and thank you very much for listening. Please help to spread the word if you'd like me to keep going. And if you can leave reviews on iTunes and ratings on iTunes and give it a thumbs up on Stitcher and things like that, please feel free to give me a shout on the website at writingtalkpodcast.com. And you can also get hold of me at mikeycampling.com. That's mikeycampling.com. And there you can sign up for my newsletter and keep in touch and get a bunch of free books and so on. So that's actually, if you thought you want to know what happens when Berlik is marching off into the night in 3500 BC and somebody jumps out or something, jumps out from behind a tree, you can get Trespass as an ebook free by signing up at mikeycampling.com/giveaway. So thanks very much for listening, and I hope to see you again soon. Goodbye. And keep writing.